This is July the 7th, 1982, and we were in Hogan Township, Dearborn County, Indiana, with the Dearborn County Oral History Project. We are interviewing Lillian Cook, and your interviewer is Sally Bauer. Mrs. Cook, I understand that you lived in Greendale during the 1937 flood, and I was just wondering if you could share some of those experiences with us.
I would be very delighted to share those experiences because I remember them so very well. My husband and I ran as the only service station that was in the safe part of the flood area. We had a service station at the corner of Probasco Street and Ridge Avenue in Greendale. It was actually the only place you could buy gas during the whole time of the flood. In January that year, it started raining quite a lot, and it kept on and on. And finally, it became very apparent that Lawrenceburg was in trouble because the levee was old. It hadn't, the last time the levee broke had been in 1913, and people were beginning to get worried. The water was beginning to lap dangerously close to the top of the levee, and they knew that with the rains that had been coming, that Lawrenceburg was doomed. So on the morning that the levee broke, people started getting out of Lawrenceburg. Everybody that had a truck helped out. They helped to carry furniture and everything else that they could. And a lot of the people that lived downtown that had things that they thought they could move up to the second floor became very disillusioned as time went on because the second floor wasn't any safer than the first floor. So that day was terrible. All day long, the brakes shrieked when the trucks would come out and turn down Probasco Street with loads of furniture. Sometimes furniture would fly off the truck and break to pieces in the street, and everybody was in a turmoil. So as the day wore on, it got worse and worse. And as night came on, we only had one light down in Lawrenceburg at that time that was a stoplight, and it was by the Catholic Church where you turn up Walnut Street. And that light went on and off and on and off. As it began dark, that was the thing I watched most of the time. And lights were still going across. I could see the lights when the cars turned out of Walnut Street and went across to Newtown, as we call it. You could see that stream of lights, people moving out of Lawrenceburg. And that went on and on until about 10:30 or 11 o'clock at night. And all at once the car stopped going across. And I knew then that the levee had broken. We had heard the levee had broken. So I watched that stoplight, and it would go on and off and on. It was the last light I ever saw in Lawrenceburg during the flood. It was the last light I saw. And that light went on and off and on and off. And finally, about midnight or so, it went off and never did come on again. And that just made you feel like Lawrenceburg was dead, you know, because everything was, you know, you felt like the light had gone out and the town was dead. Well, the next morning I woke up and I looked down and I saw that water, and it just made me sick. It came up in back of our place pretty far, see. And I looked across, and over on that railroad track some poor old cows were walking back and forth. They were shut off at one end of the railroad track. There was a levee over there, see, with a railroad track on top. And that's along by what is now Route 50.
Uh-huh.
But those poor old cows walked all day long. They'd go up as far as they could go and down as far as they could go. Well, I couldn't stand it. I felt so bad for them. I knew they were going to drown.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after that night, there was no more cows over there, and the water was over that levee by that time. Because it came up, it came very fast. It came very fast, see, at that time.
Uh-huh.
And, let's see, over in there, there was a man that had built himself a house, and he had two big dormer windows in the roof, see. And when they went to get him out, he was sitting on one dormer window with his dogs, and the other dormer window was occupied by a cow. But when they came with the boat, they couldn't get the cow into the boat, so they saved the man and his dogs, but the poor old cow was lost. Well, things went on, and the government moved in with their boats and their men that helped take care of things, and the businesses that were in Greendale at that time was the A.D. Cook Incorporated, the Seagram Distillery, and the Seagram Distillery had a electric plant, and they kept electricity going in Greendale all during the floods.
Oh, really?
Yes, they did. And the A.D. Cook company took over
the Kleenex.
Took over the the bank moved into the A.D. Cook Incorporated, see.
Mm.
And they did the business from there. And we had the Western
Galway.
Union moved in our place. And so that went on, you know. We got by the best we could, see, during the flood. But people came in, and every home was crowded with somebody, you know, that lived in with them.
Mm-hmm.
And people just got along the best they could. But it was about 2 weeks, see. I know the Neary Candy Company moved out, and Mr. Neary told me afterwards he had a lot of candy that hadn't moved. It was a new brand of something that hadn't been moving. And he said that really made him after the flood, because he sold every bar of candy. He said he thought all those people did was walk the streets and eat candy. There wasn't anything they could do but worry about what they were going to do when they got back to Lawrenceburg to clean up that mess, because it really was a mess, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But
one thing I wondered, someone told me the other day that Aurora was flooded.
Aurora was flooded. I wasn't down in Aurora, but Aurora was more fortunate than Lawrenceburg, because when the flood comes into Aurora, it comes in, and you know when it's coming, and you know how many feet to expect, and all that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
But in Lawrenceburg, they depended on that levee, see.
Mm-hmm.
And when the levee didn't hold, then they had all that water come at once, see. And that's what was so devastating about the whole thing, see.
Because it just swooshed in on everyone.
Yes, people were run to the second floors, and then they even went out and cut holes in their roofs and got onto the top of into the roof. Some of them were saved, you know, by getting out through
the roof.
Through onto the roofs of their houses.
Oh my goodness.
And we had a neighbor, Mr. Frank Everhart, who worked for... He was on a truck, and A.D. Cook had a truck that was moving people out. And as they went down Center Street, they got to the lower end of Center Street, the levee broke, and that water all came across there, and it washed him out of that truck. And he lit in a maple tree that stood alongside there, and he hung in that tree all night. Well, he was so upset, you know, that was a terrific ordeal.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that he was quite sick for several weeks after that, recovering from that horrible experience.
I can't believe it.
Yeah. And then, of course, when the government got in there, they furnished what they called Tent City. And they had, just beyond the entrance to Greendale Cemetery, those houses, that street was not organized yet, and there was a big empty lot in there, and they put all those tents in there. And a lot of the people that were living in basements and any place they could get, they moved into their own tents and had their own family together. Mm-hmm. So we had Tent City, as they called it there, for several months after the flood was over.
For months?
Oh, several months they lived in those tents, because they lived there until they got their houses cleaned up and fit to live in again, see.
How long did that take, getting over the flood and everything?
Well, the flood came about the 21st of January, and I expect it was May or June before those people got back in their homes.
Mm.
So that was quite an experience for Lawrenceburg particularly.
Uh-huh.
Now, I don't know about Aurora, because I wasn't living in Aurora at that time, but I do know that they lost a lot there, too, because nobody expected it to be as high as it was.
Mm-hmm.
This flood was much higher than it was in either 1884 or 1913.
How many feet do you know approximately that it got to?
I think it was 82, something like that.
Uh-huh.
Yes, it was quite high.
It is.
Yeah.
But when the people were getting out of Lawrenceburg, it was like panic.
Oh, it was terrific. It was just terrific. You can't imagine the excitement and the noise, and everybody was in a hurry because they wanted to get that load of furniture delivered and go back and get somebody else that was waiting, see.
Mm-hmm.
So that just went on, and everybody that had a truck was in there helping. Now, we had to get our gasoline from a train load of gasoline was sitting above Lawrenceburg there. And we always laughed because we had Sinclair gasoline at that time, and the Standard Oil truck delivered Standard Oil products to our station, and we sold anything we could get. And the people that had businesses downtown, they got so, they were so anxious to do something, and they didn't know what to do with themselves. And I remember several of them came to our station and asked if they could work and help, because they had to do something to keep from going crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to have something to keep yourself occupied. And so I remember old Mr. Granite came over and pumped gas, and Bob Hagg had just started a little service station down in Newtown, and that was washed away. And he came up and worked and repaired tires and just helped around. You know, it was mm-hmm. something for them to do.
What did people do, I mean, when they had to keep themselves busy, like at night or something like that? What would they do, just sit in the house and talk? Or?
Well, I think they worked so hard during the day walking the streets that they were probably, well, of course, there were no radios. There were radios. They could listen to the radio, but of course there was no television or anything like that. But they listened to the radio. They could listen to the radio reports.
Mm-hmm. What about the food as far, because didn't a lot, the food got contaminated. And how did they get the food in?
Well, the government sent in loads and loads of food, and they had it in the Greendale School. And everybody was in Greendale, and all the people that had moved in there all went there and got their produce, you know, all,
mm-hmm.
all kind of things that would keep, like flour and potatoes and, you know, all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, didn't the Red Cross come in?
Yes, the
time?
Red Cross probably were the ones that sent all that food and everything in.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
And don't you remember that Red Cross canned? It was canned like hash, like Denny Moore beef stew. That was the best stuff. I loved that.
I'd forgotten about that.
Remember that? They had a big can of canned stew, and it was the best stuff. I loved it.
Yeah. She was little then, and she she was, interested in food particularly. But they really took care of everything quite nicely, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The Red Cross in particular is always there when there's trouble.
Yeah, and that was trouble.
That was trouble.
Well, how old was your family then, your children?
Well, I was 39 years old. My husband was the same age. And my son was, he was 15.
Mm-hmm.
And sis was about 12, something like that.
So old
10. She was 10 then.
11.
She was 11 years old.
What did they do then?
Well,
busy.
They just, I guess they had a ball. I don't know.
I remember telegrams. Don't you remember?
She did what?
Delivered telegrams.
Oh.
They had the telegraph office in the men's restroom there in the service station?
Yeah. Yeah, we had the telegraph office there. Oh, everybody had a job. Everybody had to work. Oh, yeah.
What were some of the jobs that they had to do?
Well, it was just taking care of things that were around you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, when you have people come in, you've got extra work, and after washing and after cooking. And I was lucky. We had no gas, but we sold kerosene, and I had just bought a new stove. And it had four burners on the outside here. You know, it was a regular, nice, big kerosene stove. And then it had a oven on it, a two-burner oven. Well, I made biscuits and everything else. I spent half my time cooking to feed all these people that came in. We moved our dining room table into the kitchen and made a bedroom out of our dining room to take in some of our family that lived downtown, see?
Mm-hmm.
So the dining room table was always filled with somebody eating because they had jobs to do. I know when the fire inspector came in, he stayed at our house. And, of course, everybody came. You ate all the time or else you were walking the streets all the time.
Well, where did you walk the streets?
Well, you could walk from Seagram's up to Homestead.
Oh.
See? We were practically on an island. And there was a man had an airplane, and he landed that airplane over in the cornfield right in Greendale, where all those homes are built back
in
there now. Of course, he couldn't have done it now because those were all cornfields at that time.
In the middle of that hall and then turn right.
Well, didn't you say that when the levee broke, that I thought you said that you saw what happened, you know, as far as
I saw the lights go out, and I knew I was out in Greendale when the levee went out, but I knew when it went because you could tell because the lights quit going by, see, and
mm-hmm.
and I knew then that everybody had gotten out that was going to get out, see.
How far, it didn't really, Greendale was pretty much out of the water, weren't they?
Oh, yes.
It was
the water
down in the back of our service station, which is where that United Dairy Farmer store is.
Mm-hmm.
It was 12 foot down the bank in back of that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was down our hill there in back of us.
So that whole area was just one great big ocean from that hill clear to.
I could look towards Cincinnati, and Cincinnati Gas and Electric Company was up that way, and there was nothing but. You could see that about half of the Cincinnati Gas and Electric Company was underwater up there. There was no gas anyplace, see. And and nothing but water. Every place you looked was all water, you know. It was really something.
Everyone had to get around in boats.
Oh, yes, everybody rode in boats. Everybody, the government sent in a lot of boats there, too.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes, the government sent boats in. And well, I think we got along remarkably well. There was only one man that died, and I think he was an old gentleman that got confused, and he got as far as the Catholic Church corner, and I think when that levee broke, that he was the only one that was drowned that I ever could remember of.
Well, that's really a miracle that no one got killed, or just that one person got killed.
Yeah, there was two new service stations. It was just when service stations were being built a lot, see. See, we had the first drive-in service station that was either in Lawrenceburg or Greendale. All they had was curb pumps out in front of different places. You know, like Myers is the oldest, possibly the oldest operating place in Dearborn County today. But that place was there before the flood, long before the flood. I think they were organized in 1919. Well, our place was built in 1923. Mm-hmm. But we had a drive-in type, see, that you drove off of the street to get your products.
And then before they were just on the curb?
They're just curb pumps. You know, you drove on right on the street and got your gas.
I never knew that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, it was a great time to live through. We learned a lot, and we learned to be more thoughtful of our fellow citizens, I guess. And I think they were very grateful that mm-hmm. they were able to get out of the flood and were able to get back in their homes. Some of them didn't have homes to go back to. Some were washed away, but then the government came in and helped them build.
Oh, they did?
Yes. Some of those houses were the government helped to build.
That was very good.
And I think that's just about all I can think of the flood in 1940. Then, of course, they built the levee back and built it much higher and stronger.
Oh.
Yeah, and with that, they took Route 50 out of Greendale. Because during the flood, Route 50 went right down through Greendale, see?
Mm-hmm.
And what we had, what is now Route 50 over there along that branch of the Big Four Railroad, that was what we called, Canal Road. Because the old canal ran right down where that road was, or where the railroad was. Because after the canal quit over there, about 1860 or something like that, the railroads were coming in, see? So the railroad bought the canal property and built up a trestle
mm-hmm.
over the top of what was the old canal. And that went all the way then up to Round Brookville. That canal went all the way up to Round Brookville, see?
Mm-hmm.
And the railroads, of course, came in there in the mid-50s, 1850s. The first railroad between Lawrenceburg and Indianapolis was finished in 1853. George H. Dunn was the one that I sponsored a marker project during the 1776 bicentennial. And we put a marker at the foot of Probasco Street in Greendale. And that was denoting that Nallon Avenue
mm-hmm.
was the route of the first railroad train that went from Lawrenceburg to Chicago.
Oh.
By the way of Indianapolis.
Oh.
That was in 1853. So that was a project that the sorority did.
Mm-hmm. Phi Beta.
Phi Beta Psi sorority.
Uh-huh.
They had made me chairman of that, and I had always wanted to mark that route because I had read in history that Abraham Lincoln rode that route when he went to be inaugurated, and he made a speech at the foot of Walnut Street. You know, you've
heard
of that.
Yeah.
Well, that is the route that he was on when he made that speech. And he went right on that trestle work to Cincinnati. The trestle work I was telling you that was originally the canal.
Mm-hmm.
That was the railroad track that President Lincoln rode on. So we have a lot of historical things around in this section of Indiana that a lot of people just don't know about.
Mm-hmm. The thing about Lincoln, that's awful interesting. Could you tell us a little bit about when the people, this is going back a ways, but people coming into Aurora and Lawrenceburg and the early settlement days?
Well, the very earliest people that came down this way, of course, came by river and flatboats. Mostly they made their flatboats and loaded their living equipment and their families on up around Pittsburgh, usually someplace like that. And they floated down the river, and why they would stop at one certain place, I don't know. I think the Miami River caused Lawrenceburg to be an interesting place to stop because Fort Hamilton had been organized up at Hamilton, Ohio, And a lot of, not particularly my ancestors, when they came and went up the Miami to Hamilton and stayed over 1 year in the blockhouse at Hamilton. But we had some relatives that come there beforehand and had settled in Hamilton, and they were relatives of my great-great-grandmother. And they said, well, if we moved to the backside of hell, our poor relation would follow us. So my great-great-grandmother was a widow, and she very much resented that remark. So she took her family on over to Vincennes. Well, the family, Vincennes had become the capital of Indiana Territory in 1800. And the head of Indiana Territory at that time was William Henry Harrison. His family were friends to my great-great-grandmother's family back in Virginia. So my great-grandfather got a job on the staff with William Henry Harrison. Well, William Henry Harrison had such a terrible handwriting, you couldn't hardly read a letter that he wrote. And that's written up in history about his handwriting. Mm-hmm. I've read it over and over. So we always said that my great-grandfather got the job because he had such a beautiful script. And so the family lived in Vincennes until they were able to build their mill up Hogan Creek. They had their land, but they couldn't settle on it on account of the Indians. This was in 1810, see, and the War of 1812 was yet to come. So they stayed over there until William Henry Harrison left the governorship in 1813. He saw that as a territory, Indiana was soon to be organized as a state, because they had to have so many people in a state before it could be a state. And he saw that they were rapidly coming toward that figure. Mm-hmm. And so he decided that he would leave the governorship and take over the head of this army. He took over, I can't think of the battle, but it was the battle in which Tecumseh was killed. You remember the battle Tecumseh was killed? Oh. Well, that was, he was at the head of this army, see. Mm-hmm. And most of those people were Kentucky men. And there was, at Cincinnati was, Fort Columbia over there, and he had to go from Vincennes to pick up this army at Fort Columbia. Well, when he traveled from down southern Indiana, he came right through our farm here, because the old road that came from Cincinnati through here was the only road. See, that was the only road, went straight on through. And it's some old gentleman that lived up here at Wilmington said that William Henry Harrison had traveled that road when he went to pick up that army. So I thought that's always interesting. Now that goes through both of our farms over here and goes on around Cincinnati. You know where the entrance to the country club is?
Yes.
Well, in that gully to the left, as you're going out, there's a road, and that is the old road. You know, the country club property, that in front of that, right where they're, in front of where their porch is there, that was the this old road I'm telling you about.
Oh, yes. I never knew that.
Uh-huh. And my grandmother lived here. She lived in a two-story log house where she was born in 1841. And she said that there wasn't a day during the year that she didn't see a covered wagon going along that road, because it was one of the main roads going west, see.
That's when the people were starting to...
There's always been an interesting... I'm full of stories about things like that. And there was always a story about a family that was going west. You know, when a family traveled and they were headed west, they carried their gold with them. At night, they would dig a hole in the ground and bury it and hide it, see. And this family did that over there on a corner where they come down and go across the creek. Well, during the night, they were set on by Indians and the people were all killed. They took their horses and everything, see, but they never got the gold. And my sister and I, when we were little kids, we used to dig our hearts out over there trying to find that gold. It was supposed to be buried someplace, and to this day it's never been found.
Well, shoot, let's go out there and dig. Oh, shoot.
Well, we of course, that's a story, see.
Uh-huh.
I have no authentication, but it evidently happened, because my great-grandmother's oldest son had come to Indiana and had started a berry farm, as he called it, a fruit farm. And he was just above this location here.
Mm-hmm.
So he was here, he was married in 1805, so probably about from then on, he probably lived here, see.
Mm-hmm. He had a berry farm?
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Oh. He cleared the land over there and planted trees, you know.
Mm-hmm. The land, about what time in history did Aurora...
Aurora has a very unusual and interesting history. Aurora was first called Decatur. Did you know that?
No.
Yes. The first lands that were sold and the first properties that were sold in the city of Aurora, it was under the name of Decatur. And in 1812 or 14, Jesse Holman came into Aurora and became quite an active figure in the things around Aurora. Well, he changed that name from Decatur to Aurora. And do you know why?
No, I didn't.
Because Aurora always wanted to call that place Rising Sun, because the sun came up there so beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the meantime, Rising Sun was organized before Aurora was, so they took the name of Rising Sun. And so then Mr. Jesse Holman couldn't think of anything else but the Aurora Borealis, and he says that comes before the rising of the sun, so we'll call it Aurora.
I never knew that.
You didn't? No. Oh, yes, I've heard that all my life.
The Aurora Borealis.
Yes. He says it comes before the rising of the sun.
Now,
that Aurora was laid out in 1819.
1819?
Yeah, I know when all these cities were laid out.
Who were, you said Jesse Holmes, he was the one who named it and everything.
Pardon?
What did you say his name was? Jesse Holmes?
Jesse Holman.
Holman.
He was the one that built Veristar. His son built Veristar.
Uh-huh.
He built a log cabin up there. He and his wife were married down at Carroll. He married a girl from Carroll, and her father was an army officer, I believe. And, yes, he came in, I believe, 1811. He wasn't here a year and a half till he was a prosecuting attorney. People grew so fast. I mean, people became famous so quickly.
Uh-huh.
In this new country, see, they all had a place. And they became famous so quickly and took such prominent parts. And the first thing you know, they're serving in the government or something like that. They were just that... enterprising, see.
Uh-huh. What time, I can't think of his name, Gaff, with
Gaff.
Bill Forrest?
Well, Mr. Gaff came in by the way of I believe Harrison. I think he came from up in that direction. He wasn't here so early, see. He, around 1850, possibly. And he was a very enterprising man, too. Of course, he
mm-hmm.
built Hill Forest, you know, he would be. And he was in, I believe, before he died, they say that he was in 11 different corporations between Aurora and New York.
Oh,
the Gaff family were very, very active. Now, John Gaff was in Lawrenceburg, and Thomas Gaff was in Aurora.
He's the Hill Forest.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, whatever. Uh-huh. You know the story with the Hill Forest and the steamboats and all that.
Yeah, he had the Forest Queen, see.
Oh, that's a new one?
Yeah, his boat was Forest Queen, and it ran the blockaded Vicksburg during the Civil War. He had several boats. Uh-huh.
Oh, and then he was the captain of everything. And...
Well, a man by the name of Conaway was the captain of that boat.
Oh.
One of the Conaways out at Loughry Creek, I imagine.
He was just the owner then, or he would ride along?
I don't know about him riding along. I doubt very much whether he did, but I expect he had things to sell, probably, and had a lot of. He was a businessman first.
Mm-hmm. Before you were talking about the gambling on the riverboats and that.
That's a story in itself. I have a program that I put on numerous occasions, and I sometimes change those stories because I have so many of them. And those stories were all of. I have a book that Frank Y. Grayson, who was very prominent in Cincinnati Time Star history, and he wrote this book back in 1929, and he got true stories from people in this section of the country. I knew 11 of those people who wrote those stories that were in that book, and they were stories that were handed down, the riverboat stories that they knew about, that happened. And I've used so many of those stories on a program when I've given it, and they're very well received because some of them are real funny.
What are some of them?
Pardon?
What are some of the stories?
Well, one of the stories that I always like to tell is about a bunch of society ladies that on this side of the Miami River someplace, some small town on this side of the Miami River. And I can't tell you whether it's Lawrenceburg ladies or Aurora ladies, but I imagine it's one or the other. They all decided they wanted to ride there. To begin with, I'll go back. There was an old boat taken over that was run by an old man who was very, very odd. He wasn't the formal riverboat captain with a high hat and the spectacular adornments that those fellows wore when they were head of a boat organization, you know.
Uh-huh.
And he was he did a lot of carrying on the river because he took in everything. He would slip in ahead of these big boats and get the things that wanted to be shipped away.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was. A sort of a wily character. He knew he was a good river man. He sold his farm back in Indiana here, and his wife didn't want him to, but he always wanted to own a boat. So he buys this old boat, and he just He just made such a success of it, because he didn't care how he looked, And so these ladies all got on the boat. And they got on in the evening, and the next morning for breakfast, some of them got dressed earlier than the others, and they wanted to get out there and get the captain's table. So they got the captain's table and sat down there, and who should walk in but this disreputable looking old fellow with his hair not combed. He was barefooted, and he just was a sight. And of course they were very disappointed because they thought they would have a mutton chop character with a high silk hat and a lordly looking creature, you know, to be the captain of a boat. So they sat down at the table. They said that there were a lot of red faces around the table because they were not expecting that character to be the captain of the boat. Well, the stories, when they tell about him, how he moved his long whiskers aside and swiveled his coffee down and made all kind of noises and said the awfulest things to people. And the first thing he said to these ladies, he says, "Well, ladies, how's your corns this morning?" And they were all shocked, of course. Well, the whole thing went like that.
Uh-huh.
After he got finished eating and completely demoralized the whole thing, he walks away, and as he goes through the door, he meets his first mate there, and he winks at him, and he says, "I bet that'll cure them dames from sitting at the captain's table."
Oh, no.
That's a true story. That was told.
And it was in that book.
Yeah, it's in the book. And I think Frank Y. Grayson did a beautiful job of writing that. He didn't want to in the beginning, but he was urged to by the Carrolls. The Carrolls had a big boat dock up and built boats, you know.
Up where?
At Cincinnati.
Oh.
Yeah, there was a lot of boat building at all these big cities along the Ohio River, you know.
Because of transportation.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Means. Yeah.
But riverboat stories are always colorful, you know.
Yeah.
There's something about the river that just takes everybody.
Yeah, it's mesmerizing.
Well, the Aurora was our lifeline. The river was our lifeline in the beginning. See,
mm-hmm.
It was
where everything came in.
Everything came by the river.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's why all those cities were built.
Yeah,
on the river.
You'll find there's always a city on the river. Wherever mm-hmm. you go, there's a city on the river. And of course, when they got back from the river, they had to fight all the denseness and the trees and the forests and everything to get through.
Mm-hmm. When they were first starting out. Yeah.
Now, you know, the people that came in, if they found a stream they could follow, now like Hogan Creek. Now, my family built this road out here.
Oh.
They built this road out here that goes all the way up to the mill.
See? When was that?
About 1815.
1815. Was it still called North Hogan?
I don't know what they called it. It was just a road, you know.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I always remember a story about an old man. It was a Scotchman that lived up here. And he was so tight. And he never spent a nickel that he didn't have to. And he was coming home from Aurora one night and scuffling through the leaves. It was in the fall. And he lost a nickel out of his pocket. And they asked him what in the world he did. He says, well, I just curled up in the leaves and laid there. And the next morning he laid there and he got up and it got light and he found his nickel and went on home.
That's pretty tight, I would say. Oh, well, you know pretty much about Lawrenceburg's.
Oh, yes, I know a lot about Lawrenceburg. Lawrenceburg was laid out in 1802 by Samuel Vance. And at the time Lawrenceburg was laid out, we were a part of Hamilton County. Did you know that?
No.
All of Dearborn County, part of Franklin County, all of Ohio County, and a part of Switzerland County were all a part of Ohio.
A part of Ohio?
Yes. Hamilton County.
Hmm. Oh, yes. That's right, yeah.
I have never been able to figure out why that is, but I think it might be because General Arthur St. Clair, you know his name in history,
mm-hmm.
General Arthur St. Clair's granddaughter married the man that started Lawrenceburg. Samuel Vance
mm-hmm.
started Lawrenceburg. And I wondered if he wanted that to go in with Ohio because he had plans then to be the first governor of Ohio, which he was.
The Vance or the grandfather?
The grandfather. Arthur St. Clair.
Uh-huh.
So I have figured, that's just in my mind, you know, I try to find out a reason for everything that everybody did. Well, I couldn't think of any other reason why he wanted to take in this part of the country because he was the one that instigated that slice, as they called it.
Mm-hmm.
They called it the gore. Don't you remember that in history? When you study Indiana Territory, there was a gore taken off next to the Ohio line.
Hmm.
And the Ohio line ran clear over here and took in just a little nip of the Ripley County. That took in all of our county. And
oh my gosh.
That's the way it was. So when Samuel Vance went to lay out how do I want to say, these plans had to be taken to the courthouse.
Survey?
The plot. He had to register the plat or the plot or what it,
uh-huh.
the plat. He had to register that at the courthouse, and he had to go to Hamilton County, Cincinnati, to do that. Can you imagine? And if he had waited 1 month, the government changed that line back. He laid out Lawrenceburg April the 8th, 1802, and the 1st of May, 1802. The government of the United States changed that line back to the Miami River where it is today.
So, oh my.
Pittsburgh was laid out in 1802, Samuel Vance registered the plat at the courthouse. And the courthouse at that time, as we were a part of Hamilton County, had to be in Cincinnati. But if he had waited 1 month, he registered that plat on April the 2nd, 1802. And on May the 1st, 1802, the U.S. government changed that line from where it was then back over to the Miami River where it is today. Mm-hmm. So you can see that our plat for Lawrenceburg is still in the Hamilton County Courthouse, and we've never been able to get it back.
They won't give it back?
Well, we had it down there at Lawrenceburg when we celebrated the sesquicentennial. They sent that plat down for us to look at, and I went down to the courthouse to look at it because I was interested, you know. And I thought, well, that would be the oldest piece of anything that we could have to do with this part of the country. Mm-hmm. But we don't have it.
Is it just that Hamilton County doesn't have it, or they won't turn it over?
Well, they had it then.
They just won't
turn
it over?
They showed it to us. They brought it down and let us look at it.
Take a quick picture of it.
I went down to the courthouse. It was in the recorder's office, and I went down to the courthouse to look at it. See?
Oh, my gosh. That's dirty.
Oh, well, that's just all a part of history, you know.
What did Lawrenceburg do after, like, some of the early settlers in Lawrenceburg?
Well, I'll tell you, Lawrenceburg grew quite fast because there were some enterprising families that came in there. We had some marvelous people that came into Lawrenceburg that helped build up that town, see. Mm-hmm. The Samuel Vance was one of them. And then General Dill. Did you ever hear of General Dill in history?
Yes.
He was an Irish barrister that lived in Lawrenceburg, had a beautiful home there. And he had married into the St. Clair family, too.
Mm-hmm.
He had married a daughter of General Arthur St. Clair. So name St. Clair and Vance, it's a sort of a family, I think. It seems like a family affair. I know when my great-great-grandfather gave the land for the first courthouse up here in Wilmington, that Arthur St. Clair, or Vance Jr., was the surveyor. I have copies. I go to the courthouse and have copies made of everything that's controversial, because I don't like to tell stories unless I can prove that they're right. So I have copies of that sort of thing whenever I want to.
Is that some of the documents?
Pardon?
Is that some of the documents you have there?
Well, now those documents there are from my great-grandfather Johnston. He was a self-educated gentleman that was one of the builders of the mill up Hogan Creek. He was the one that served on the staff with William Henry Harrison when he was first governor of the Indiana Territory in 1810. And I've often wondered, these things I have here are problems that he worked out. Now, this will go to the Indiana Historical Society when I'm dead, because they are dated 1813. January the 1st. There are books and books here of problems he worked out, and some of them are so fascinating because he drew pictures with some of his, and he even had some of them in poetry. So these have been terribly used probably over the years, but I have every one of them this is the way I found them when I don't know where they came from, my family someplace, and I have them. I'll show you where I have the... He had beautiful... Now, this isn't his beautiful handwriting. That's somebody else's. But I can tell my grandfather's because he had such beautiful handwriting.
It is.
Look at the...
That's really... My goodness. And then he has all the pictures and everything like that.
Yeah, he drew... Here's drew picture there, see?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and he founded the mill.
Well, yes, he and his brothers. He and his brothers. There were three brothers that founded the mill, and their mother was a Kyle, and her brother was with George Washington in the Revolutionary War, and I put on a program last fall for the Yorktown celebration because he was a twin brother to my great-great-grandmother. And so I put on a program and rededicated his marker last fall to celebrate the Yorktown centennial.
My goodness.
Yeah, we got, DAR gave us some. We got, I forget how many awards last year. I got two myself. I had sent in the most material on the battle of Lawry Creek.
Oh, you know a lot about that?
Oh, heavens, yes.
Oh, my gosh, tell me about that.
Yeah, well, Lawry, of course, General Lawry, you know, was, you read the story about General Lawry. I don't know why George Rogers Clark didn't wait for him.
I know. They would have got
That's
so
always
much more.
What's worried me, because he wouldn't have had that trouble if they could have gotten together. But it just looked like that whether George Rogers Clark's men were forcing him to go, I do not know. I just don't know. But that was a terrific thing to happen. You know, we have people here in Dearborn County whose ancestors were in that. And lived through it. And they came back and settled here in Dearborn County. They liked the country so well.
Cool.
So I expect that just about takes care of the stories if you